Well, good afternoon, everybody, or good evening, depending on wherever you are. The Stranger in the Mirror is the fourth domestic suspense thriller by Liv Constantine, whom you might be able to deduce, watching the screen, are actually two sisters. So we have Valerie and we have Lynn. Valerie, that's you. Lynn, that is you. And the outlier, but equally welcome and exciting, is my old friend, Kate White, who has a new book called The Fiancé. Kate's in leopard skin. I think it's a hangover from when she was the editor-in-chief at Cosmo. She stalked the halls. And I mean, I spent a day at Cosmo with Kate. I was saying that earlier. I was exhausted when it was over. They kept having these moments when, what was it, Kate? What was that thing? It was like a whistle would blow or something, and everybody would rush to some kind of emergency meeting, usually to do with fashion.
It must have been something my fashion department was doing without my realizing it. I don't remember a whistle.
Well, it was something like that. Anyway, so Kate lived a life of actual suspense, which she then resigned and translated into her writing career. So she's the author of 8 Bailey Wiggins mysteries and 7 standalone suspense, as well as some popular career advice volumes. So today, we're all going to discuss these two new books. And before I forget, we have autographed copies of Stranger in the Mirror, which is wonderful. And we have signed book plates for The Fiancé. So don't hesitate or miss out on purchasing them. Lots of things in common, ladies, to talk about here. Family, what is a family? What do we do when we have outliers or suspicious kinds of behavior within families? What do we do if we have a new person introduced into a family? Who can we trust? All those good questions. So where should we start? Should we start with you two, the Constantine sisters?
Sure.
Yeah. So I think the premise of this book is really fascinating, and it's a 2-track story. So why don't you tell us about, briefly, unfortunately, we can only talk about the book so far. It would be so much better if we could just like discuss the entire book, if you guys managed to read it in the last hour before
we get going. That would be great. Yes, better.
Oh, we can't do that. Yeah. So let's see. Why doesn't Valerie tell us about Addison's story, and Lincoln tell us about Addison, well, we don't know for sure who he is. Julian's story, right?
Sure.
So, Valerie.
Okay. So, all right. Addison Hope is a woman who has no idea of what her past is. She was picked up on the side of the road, bleeding, hurt, picked up by a trucker on the highway in New Jersey, and didn't have any recollection of her past, of what had happened prior to her being picked up. She suffers from amnesia. So she's taken home with this trucker. He takes her home to his wife, who is a nurse. They care for her. She lives with them for 2 years. Addison isn't really even her name. It is a name that she's adopted. And when the book opens, she is at her engagement party to this wonderful young man that she's met. She's been living in Philadelphia for the last 2 years. She's known him for 6 months. They're in love, but she's having very conflicted feelings about this wedding that's about to take place because she doesn't know who she is. She doesn't know if she has a family somewhere or if there's someone looking for her. The only things that she does know about herself is that there are 2 terrible scars that run up her arms, on each arm. So she knows that she did something to try to harm herself. She doesn't know why, and she doesn't know who, if she was running from someone or what. And that is the beginning of her story. And then a few hundred miles away, Lynn.
In Boston, in a suburb of Boston, in Brookline, Julian is celebrating, celebrating might be the wrong word, but remembering his anniversary with his missing wife, Cassandra, and his little 7-year-old daughter, Valentina, is asking about her mother and why her mother has left. And he's trying to explain to her that she didn't mean to leave, but he doesn't really know what happened to her. And so he's struggling with whether or not to move on. It's been 2 years. The police have not been able to find her despite every effort on his part. It's like she vanished into thin air. He has no idea where she is. And so he kind of tells himself he's going to give it a few more months. And then at that point, the only fair thing is to let his daughter know that her mother's not coming back. But before that happens, a chance encounter brings the two of them together. And from there, the story goes into a different direction.
So we have two narrators, right? And we know one is unreliable because she has no idea who she is at this point or what her history is. We don't know all that much about Julian, except he's trying to be a great dad. And this little girl is really suffering from the absence of her mother. And generally in a story like this, if you have two story tracks, at some point they converge, right?
Right.
Otherwise, what are we doing?
What's the point?
Drive off.
Right.
So, it's really a wonderful book full of surprises. And I think ladies, the thing I liked the most about it was how supportive Addison, right? That's okay. I'm going to step away here and turn off the leaf blower. If I close the door, the leaf blower guy won't be so audible. What can I say? What was I saying? I think that the family that basically took Addison in are wonderful because, you know, you would think that they would have every reason to not welcome her or be hostile to her relationship. And yet they're so supportive, you know. You obviously could have made them differently. So why did you decide to do that?
Do you mean Gabriel's family? Or
is it Gabriel? Yeah, the family that took Addison in. So Gabriel's family.
So we, you know, we didn't want, we knew that he was from, you know, a wealthy family in Philadelphia. They're a close family. And we didn't want his mother to be sort of, you know, the stereotypical disapproving mother that wasn't going to like any girl that he brought home. And we actually brought Blythe because she's our third point of view character. We thought it was important to have her point of view as the mother. And she is conflicted about, she feels bad for Addison. She thinks she's a lovely young woman. She sees that her son is happy. But of course, she's very concerned about what's going to happen if all of a sudden Addison remembers a whole past history. What if she has a husband? What if she has children? You know, and her son is sort of naively in love and just assuming that everything's going to be fine and that's going to take care of it. And of course, she's the wiser of the two, and she knows that that's probably not what's going to happen. So she has to temper her worry with respecting the relationship, you know, and trying to be kind to Addison while at the same time looking out for her son. So she's the one who begins sort of investigating and trying. Also, you have, you know, in addition to Addison trying to discover her past, now you have Blythe, her fiance's mother, also looking into her and making sure that there's nothing suspicious or nothing that's going to hurt her son.
So this is a family with a tight-knit fabric, and, you know, protective and yet welcoming.
Right.
And Kate, that sort of takes me over to you because certainly the fiance, the family in it is extraordinary. You must have had fun creating this whole family. So, you know, what inspired you to do that?
It's interesting because like Blythe's family, Gabe's family, they are affluent, the Keatons, and there's a little similarity there. I love The Stranger in the Mirror. Just happen to have my copy here. But the Keatons they're two parents in their early 70s. They have four sons. There are three wives. And then this new woman who comes into the picture. And I just was really interested in the idea of a family where the ecosystem is disrupted. And the Keens have a pretty magical family. I mean, there are a lot of secrets that you find out through the book, but at first glance, it seems pretty magical. And Summer, the protagonist, is just kind of in awe of this family because of not just their wealth, but their charm and their charisma and the whole landscape of everything. But then this person who comes in, Hannah, really starts to throw everything off.
I wanted to go on vacation with the Keats. I love the family too.
I did.
I really wanted to be there. Such a great book.
It was a great book.
Yeah.
And it is a magical place, you know, the home that the mother has created and the whole family atmosphere is terrific. But we know from the beginning when Summer looks at Hannah, this newcomer, and realizes that she has encountered her before. It's like the snake slithering into Eden, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, you can go,
and Hannah pretends not to have remember Summer, and they're both actresses, Hannah more successful. And part of Summer's problem in trying to convince people in the family that there's danger there and Hannah may be behind it is that there's a little, you know, sense even from her husband that there's jealousy on Summer's part. And there is, Summer says about Hannah, because Hannah's shooting a Netflix pilot. Am I the only one on the freaking planet that's not shooting a Netflix pilot? And so that gets in the way, but we know as the reader right away that Hannah has lied. And as Summer says, she told me a big fat lie and I'm not sure why.
But we have to buy into the idea that Summer is reliable. You know, there's always a chance in these books because you guys put so many trapdoors into them. There's always a chance that Summer is actually the problem and Hannah is okay. Right. I mean, we don't know that, you know, until, I'm not spoiling anything. As we move along in the book, we find out that different people, you know, that as Kate says, has secrets or they have agenda, but you're never 100% sure who it is that you can trust.
Well, I think with the genre, because we've seen so many unreliable narrators, we are never sure. Even when the protagonist starts off pretty much telling us, you can trust me, we're not sure these days.
No, that's very true. Right, well, you must have questions you'd like to ask each other. So obviously, Kate, you have read the Constantine book and you sisters have read Kate's book. What would you like to ask the sisters?
Oh, wow. One of the things that really intrigued me, because I did a book once that had to do with very temporary amnesia. I've just found that whole subject so fascinating. And I had been inspired by a piece in the New Yorker about a young woman who experienced this sort of dissociative state. And I'm just curious how you guys got interested in it. And did you do some research on it? What did you find out? Because it's such a chilling aspect. And particularly in this case, it lasts such a long time. And even when things begin to point to her identity, she still doesn't remember. And one of the things I found out is that amnesia actually is a little bit more common than we realize, that we think of it as something that just happens in crime novels. But it is a bit more common. I'd love to know how you've researched it and how you got interested in that as a plot point.
I think the idea of that when we talked about the idea for the book, the excitement was twofold. And the first was, of course, a character with amnesia, but secondly was the research that we would be able to do and the reading we would do. So of course we both did a lot of reading, and then we didn't actually talk to people with amnesia, but because of this wonderful thing called the internet and people posting, there were so many people who posted on or blogged about what it is like to have amnesia. So it was almost as if we could have interviews with people who really suffered from amnesia, which helped us really to get into what their thoughts are, what it feels like, because you can imagine what it would be like to not remember anything, but you can remember. You do know your past. You do know who your family is. So to be able to talk to people, or at least read what they've said about having amnesia and what that feels like every day, waking up and not knowing who you are, not being able to, for example, as in the case of Addison, not being able to get a driver's license or open a bank account or get a social security number, because she didn't have a birth certificate. And there are people in this situation. And the answer for them is, sorry. I mean, this is what the government agencies say to them. Sorry, we can't do anything for you. So that was another aspect that we hadn't thought that much about, but another really difficulty in the life of somebody who has retrograde amnesia, which is what she has, forgetting everything. And then there were some fascinating studies and experiments, and I'll turn it over to you, Lynn, for one of the great ones we found.
One of the things that we had to explore with having a character with amnesia, of course, she doesn't know herself. And so to try to have a fully developed character who doesn't know herself was a challenge. So we knew that we had, of course, we knew her backstory and what trauma she had had. And so we were exploring a lot of research about mind and body and the trauma that your body may feel that your mind could forget, but your body still knows. And this idea that all of that trauma, you know, is physical as well as emotional and mental. And so we've actually found that that was true, but also more surprising for us was the fact that you can carry in your body trauma from ancestors. And the way that they have inferred that is there was a study done with mice where they put a substance in that smelled like cherry blossoms. And at the same time, they would do an electric shock to the mice's little feet. Over a period of time, of course, the mice would associate the smell of cherry blossoms with the pain, and they would cower and they would get anxious. They then bred these mice with mice that had not been exposed to that. And two generations later, the mice pups who had never had the shock or when they smelled the cherry blossoms began to tremble with fear. So even though they had no actual experience with it, it was embedded in their genetic material. So I'm sure there's a ton of research still to be done. And you know, that opens up a lot of questions, but that was just really fascinating for us as well. And so we tried to infuse in Addison, not necessarily generational trauma, but certain things that would trigger her. So she may smell something that she didn't know why, but it made her feel sick, or she would see something and she would, you know, get nervous about that. And so it was really interesting to play around with all of those.
Yeah, that's so fascinating. But I'm thinking of a horror movie, Revenge of the Tortured Mice, that
yes, I know, it's so true.
You mentioned something that I was actually going to ask you a question about, if I could, because I thought it was great and not what I was expecting, but you added that third point of view of Blythe. And I just thought, hey, now, at first I didn't quite like her because I saw her having an agenda, but then when it was interesting to see her point of view and understand her a bit better. And just as you say, she wants to protect her son because what could happen? And this could maybe go to a bigger question about your process, because it's so interesting, the two of you writing together. Was that something just from the very beginning you decided we're going to get Blythe's point of view in here? Or as your writing evolved, was that just a eureka moment where, you know what will make this interesting if we all of a sudden bring in Blythe to this, her point of view, we know her better because of that?
I think it was the eureka. I don't think we planned it from the beginning, right? We realized that.
I don't think we did either.
Yeah, that she would be a valuable point of view. And it was a little different as well for us, because usually we're in just the main protagonist or maybe her best friend or something like that. So this was different in that, and also in having a male point of view from the way that we usually write. So.
Well, she's interested in protecting her son, but in a larger sense, she's also interested in protecting her family. Yes. You know, not just the son, but the intrusion of somebody where, you know, you don't know all the things that you would like to know about a new family member. I was wondering, you know, I mean, there are all kinds of medical privacy issues and so forth connected today. It's much harder to do things. But one thing, for example, they could have determined is whether she'd had a child. You know, that is something that could have been determined, which would have given some sort of insight.
Well, right. They did determine that she hadn't had a child. So we had to work around that as well, which we won't say, obviously, for people who haven't read it, but yeah.
Right. I mean, amnesia can be, there are various forms of it. And, you know, there are people who amnesia only relates to a time frame specific to whatever the injury or trauma was. They can remember right. what happened up until that moment, and then they can go forward. But there's a, you know, a whole blank space. It isn't necessarily their entire life that they can't remember. So, you know, there are different forms of it. I remember a really horrifying book, I can't remember who wrote it, about somebody whose amnesia only related to the present. She couldn't remember anything in the present. She could remember the past. So every Before moment in the present was like it had just, you know, was brand, it was just horrible to deal with.
Is that the one, Before I Go to Sleep?
You know, it was the one I'm thinking of was a long time ago, but I think it's been written about. And I'm not sure there wasn't a movie that.
There was, and it was the guy you like, Valerie.
What's her name? One war of. I'm trying to think. It was Nicole a Barrymore, Kidman. Wasn't it? Drew Barrymore in a movie. He was similar in
51st Dates. Drew Barrymore.
Right, but Drew, but the one you're thinking of, is Nicole Kidman and the guy who was in Pride and Prejudice.
Colin Firth
was her husband in it, and she would have to like make little notes and hide them, and then she wouldn't even remember that she had made the notes. It was really
that was such a good book.
There are about 7 different kinds of amnesia. You're right, it's very
I ask another question of the lovely sisters who to me look so much alike, though, even with their glasses. You're not fraternal twins, right?
No.
We have a lot of you separating us, actually. You're very sweet. That was, you like made my evening. So thank you.
Lynn, I hope you weren't offended. I guess, you know, I've read all your books and you have such great twists. I mean, The Wife Stalker had a fabulous twist. This one has fabulous twists. Are you feeling as authors today, there's the genre's exploded. Every reader talks about, I love the twists. Are you feeling pressure to do twists that at the same time manage to be credible for your readers? And what do you check with yourself to say, I'm okay with that because it doesn't jump the shark, as they say in TV, when something becomes ludicrous.
Right.
How do you measure that for yourselves?
It is challenging, right, Valerie? I mean, you know, we do it really in revision. I mean, typically it takes a long time for us to decide on the type of twist, you know, the type of story it's going to be. And then once we do have that main twist and we write our first draft and, you know, then we get feedback from our agent or from a freelance editor. And typically it's like, well, you're on the right track, but not shocking enough, and so we just keep at it. But again, to your point, we don't want it to be, it has to make sense for the character. So it often involves just kind of taking a step back and looking at it in a different way, or maybe, you know, changing a few things, or maybe introducing a new character that wasn't there before to bring it around. But it's definitely a challenge. And then we're always saying, well, if we do this, people will expect that, but then they might not, because when you expect that, we don't do, you know, it can drive you crazy. As you know, for the same, I want to turn around and ask you.
What about your
ending was so shocking. And I was wondering, did you know all along in The Fiancé how the book was going to end, or did that change as you were writing it, you know, and how did you sort that out?
I always know. I'm not a big plotter in the sense that, like Elizabeth George, where she once wrote about how to do it and, you know, you do this huge outline, but I always know who the killer is, and I have a sense of how I might try to disguise the killer with some red herrings, but also give a clue so that people don't feel gypped at the end.
Right.
That was one thing, as much as I love P.D. James, when I compare her to Ruth Rendell, her Inspector Wexford series, at the end of every Inspector Wexford, I felt she had laid out clues and I just stupidly missed them. Where P.D. James, I sometimes would feel like, whoa, that was really the illegitimate child and she never told us that. Mm-hmm. And so I do try to leave clues. And I once had an editor who I only had for one book because my editor had left, say something to me about, oh, I was hoping you were going to make it so-and-so as the killer. Could you change it to him? And I was like, wait, no, that's the no. Don't
worry. That's not who killed her, right?
Yeah. So, but I'm sure like you guys, I feel part of the fun is having discovery as you write and realizing that somebody's going to do this or that, and you didn't see it coming. One of the things that actually, funnily enough, kind of helped me when I was first starting, I read some books on magic and how magicians use misdirection. And I found it really interesting because a lot of times with magic, the trick has happened earlier than you thought it happened, and he's doing these things or she's doing these things. Actually, I interviewed a fabulous female magician for just to help me understand a bit better, and I found that very helpful.
That's really smart. So the sleight of hand, because that is what we're trying to do, right? You're trying to like look over here while we're doing something over here.
Yeah.
Very so awesome. often well, in these books, you know, how
I would
you
like
feel
to know about, oh, I'm sorry.
You go ahead.
Go ahead, Barbara. I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. Go
I was good, just going to
say mine.
You know, I loved the relationship, you know, with her mother-in-law, how close they were, and the whole family dynamic was so amazing. And then, of course, this interloper coming in who just changes everything. But so how, I mean, you really did such a great representation of a close, loving family who, you know, with the in-laws, the daughters-in-law who are coming in. And I guess as a mother of three sons, you know, with hoping that I would, that they would all marry women, you know, who we all would like, and the girls would all get along. And that. So were any of your characters based on any, or the family based on your family, or how did you made it so real? You just made it so real.
I kind of based it a bit on the families of guys I had dated, but not my husband. And it was only when I'm, you know, halfway through that I realized, wait, there are four sons and I have five brothers. But I didn't base any of the characters on my brothers. One kind of fascinating thing that happened to me a few years ago that I think influenced me to some degree with this is that after my mom died, one of my brothers was the executor, and he was telling me that a small IRA was missing in action, and the bank would not give him any information. And he was talking to a fairly junior person, and he said, look, I'm the executor. I need to know what's happened. And she said, well, the check already went out. So he thought, okay, I'm going to get it. And then the check never arrived. So finally calls up somebody higher. And it turns out that the check had been sent out to a woman that he didn't recognize the name. And he said to me, have you ever heard of, I'll just say Barbara Peters. And I said, no, I've never, I don't know who that is. And then one of my other brothers mentioned a cousin of ours who had been married a bunch of times. And he said, I think one of the husband's name was Peters. So all of a sudden we realized my cousin had gotten the check and we of course were wondering, had my mother left her this money? And so my brother called my cousin, and she had gotten the check, and she said she had used it to redo some of her home construction, and then sent some money to charity. Not sure about that, but since my mother had mild Alzheimer's before she died, my brother said, well, didn't you want to question why you'd gotten this check? And she says, well, I know your mom really liked me. So we were all kind of shocked, but the bank ate it. They did not claw back the money from her, but they wrote a check for the estate. This small, fortunately, it was a small portion, but it made me realize, oh my gosh, The moment where we wondered, did my mother have an illegitimate child she was leaving the money for? And then discovering the cousin had not raised her hand and said, hey guys, I think you should know. Oh. That, I think, really started me thinking about the secrets families keep when you don't even have any sense that that's going on there. Mm. And I think that's what I wanted to write and have unfold, that this family that looks so charismatic and seems so tight-knit, there are these secrets that unfold themselves as the book goes on.
You did a masterful job with it. You really did. Yeah. So what I was going to mention is that oftentimes how people die, how people are killed, is the method of it isn't really that important in books. You know, I mean, you can stab them or shoot them or, you know, whatever it all is. But Kate went to some length in The Fiancé to come up with an interesting, which unfortunately we can't discuss because it'll be a spoiler, but she went to a lot of trouble to come up with an interesting way to kill somebody. And I was going to ask you, Kate, you know, did you actually research it or even try this method out on anybody?
Yeah,
I've
told my husband, do not worry. But when I was editing the Mystery Writers of America cookbook, I will just say there were a bunch of sidebars that I wrote myself. And in one of them, I learned something that I used in the book. And what makes it interesting is it's a way to kill somebody that actually is very rarely detected.
Cool.
So, but I take no responsibility if anyone copies that.
I was thinking there might have been more unfortunate mice. You know,
those mice, I feel so bad, the little shock to them.
I know.
So one of the other things I thought was really interesting about Summer as a character is that she, it is a happy family. She's in a happy marriage and so forth, but she hasn't figured out her own career path very well. You know, she's having a hard time coming to some sort of professional place. So, I mean, she's almost like a sort of semi-unfinished person, you know, as we're working our way through the book. And one of the nice things is, and this is a spoiler, but not a big one, is that she gets to a place at the end of the book where she is, in fact, a more content or more self-actualized, if that's the right word. And I thought that was interesting that you introduced, and you know, because you have written books, career advice, and you know, mentored a lot of women, Kate, I wondered if, you know, Sumner was in a way kind of a person that you were thinking of her in a mentoring way while you were writing her.
Well, I did actually think of people I know who have struggled, Summer's an actress and she comes to New York having majored in theater and things start off well, but before long things kind of stall and she starts doing voiceover work, which is actually very lucrative, but she doesn't really want to be doing that. She doesn't want to be the person saying, listen carefully because our menu options have changed. She says she'd have to shoot herself if that was going to be the rest of her life. And my career, though it was bumpy the first 10 years in my 20s, by my late 20s, it had taken off on a pretty good trajectory. And I certainly had moments where there were singe marks on my butt, but overall I had a very good career and it was really fun. But I certainly know people who've struggled at certain points in time. And my husband was a news anchor for many years. And after 9/11 decided, you know, I'd love to try something else. It was just after covering that and everything. So he had been a double major in college and majored in theater. So he went back and started doing theater in New York. And so I not only listened to all his stories, but we sometimes entertained people he was in plays with. And I remember this one night we had the cast over and there were four young people in the cast who were about in their 20s, but they were playing 17-year-olds. And I said to him, gosh, of the four of them, they're all so talented, what percentage will make it? And he said, maybe only one out of the four, if that. And one out of the four was Amy Schumer. So she did make it. And she made it big time. But I was just so intrigued with what happens when you're in a field where the cream doesn't always rise to the top. I mean, that's true with acting and theater. It's about timing and breaks. And so I wanted to have a character who struggled with that and had to find her way out of that. It's just a small part of it, but it plays a big part in the sense that she is jealous of the fiance, and that affects her ability to convince others that there's the death that occurred isn't natural, that they have reason to be afraid.
But she's a great mom. She's a good mother, stepmother.
Yeah,
that sort of rounded out her character.
You know, well,
balanced me.
Thank you for saying that, because though I didn't base Henry on anything in my own life, I was fortunate enough. My husband and I have two kids of our own, but he had a child from a previous marriage, and I have a great stepson, and he was, he's now 40, but when I came into the picture, he was young, and he was just always so wonderful to me. And I was saying to my daughter the other day, how lucky is that? He never gave me any grief. Maybe when he was 16, a little bit, but other than that, nothing.
So reverting back to children, you two did a wonderful job writing the little girl in this book. And she's a really key figure. Even though she doesn't have, what's the common word now? Agency. She doesn't have a lot of having an agency are becoming two of my least favorite words. I'm just telling you right now.
What was the first one?
I agree.
What was the first one?
Pivot.
Pivot. Oh, okay.
I'm tired of pivot and I'm tired of agency. But because agency is shorthand for a whole lot of things at the moment. But anyway, the little girl doesn't have much of it, but nonetheless, she's a really important figure in the book. And you know. Did you enjoy writing her? Did you have to, you know, rein back or push her forward? How did you manage to make her so important and yet, you know, not let her take over?
It was fun. We've had children in most of our books, actually, I think, except last time I saw you didn't have much, but those books that had children that were written years ago when my children were younger were easier for me. Now my kids are 20. And I have two wonderful stepsons too, when we were saying that, who are terrific, who are older. So fortunately, Valerie has a granddaughter who just turned 6, because I was writing some things for Valentina and Valerie would say, well, I think that's a little mature for 7. I don't think she would really say that. This is how Virginia would say it. So it was very good.
You do forget when
you do, yeah.
When you're kids are grown, right? Unless you're around little ones. And I also have two really terrific stepsons. So we have another thing in common.
Yes.
So Valerie, did you take the lead then in writing Valentina?
You know, I don't think I took the lead, but in dialogue, I maybe did some edits on Lynn's work. Well, maybe she would say it this way, or maybe she wouldn't have that thought. But we each wrote her. So,
well, as this book moves along, Valentina's stake in the story rises. You know, it really does. And you know, so I think she's a. Now I'm going to use this word. She's a pivotal character. Nonetheless.
Crucial character.
But I mean, she really is, because, you know, she and I'm trying to remember, is it Blake? Is that the name of the son that Addison? Sorry, I'm having a senior moment. Addison, her fiance.
Oh, Gabriel?
Gabriel.
Gabriel. I mean, Valentina and Gabriel really are the people that have such a big, I mean, Addison obviously does, but each of them has such a big stake in this story, you know, as it moves along. I think you did a wonderful job balancing all of it, but it still was clear who, when you read the book, who my sympathies, as I read the book anyway, I can't speak for anybody else, obviously. My sympathies were so engaged with both of them, hoping, you know, that they weren't going to be completely shattered. And it would be different for, you know, for a little girl versus a grown man. Shatter right. means different things, you know, to people. And I thought you did a very fine job with Thank all you. That. And then as you bring the stories together, how that works out. As I said, I really wish we could talk about the whole book.
I right. know. It's fun to do a book club because then, you know, right, when you're when with a group that read, it, yeah. read the book, it, yeah, you can say a lot more. It's so hard to discuss spoiler-free.
Well, years ago, Manette Walters and I did a number of things together. She was, as you can remember, a really ragingly popular author way back in the 90s, and then she kind of went quiet. But I remember having a discussion with her in the store in which she said that a book needs to have an end that delivers on the beginning, that a book has to have an end as powerful as the beginning, yes. or the reader is always going to be disappointed. And we've all had the experience of reading books that have just great setups, you know, a really propelling, yeah. propulsive event. And it never really quite comes off, mm. you know. And I was thinking of that because I think in this genre, that's a particular danger, that it really is possible, you know, to have disappointment. And I read your books back to back because I knew we were going to do this together. And I was so pleased that in both cases, I thought that your books really did deliver an end that was, you know, delivered on the promise of the beginning. So, you know, well.
We always know, Barbara, if, you know, if our ending makes us cry, which it does, you know, we're always surprised, even on its third or fourth reading, and we'll say to each other, and maybe cry again, then we know that we've done what we needed to do, because if we have that feeling, so.
But you also want it to be the right, I mean, you want the characters to get to an ending that is good for them as well as you as the reader. I mean, in some books, there is no way that the characters are going to have a happy ending. You know, I mean, that's just part of the book.
Yeah. Well, I think it's particularly challenging now that the first page, it used to be the first chapter has to hook the reader. Now it's the first page, it's the first sentence.
Yeah, it's first line.
Of attention span. And I look back at some of my earlier books and they're just not as fast as the ones that today, because you write based on a little bit reflecting what you read, what the marketplace is like. And so because you have to start with such a bang, then it is tricky, as you say, Barbara, to make the ending have a bang that's not only a bang, but a bang that doesn't seem far-fetched in some terrible way.
And that is satisfying.
Yeah.
Or is too punishing, you know? Books, I think domestic suspense probably has a larger, I'm never in a good place to judge this because I have a gender neutral customer base. We have as many men, actually, we probably have more men in our customer base than we do women. And yet I hear often, you know, that women are the preponderance of the book buyers or that most books are read by women and so forth. And that's just not my experience. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think you have to keep that in mind when you're writing a story that you think perhaps more women are going to be reading than men, that, you know, you would go for a somewhat... It would affect, I think, how you shape the story and how you deliver the end of it. I might be wrong because I'm not a writer.
Yeah, you know, even in this one, I mean, we changed the ending a little bit, and we our sisters-in-law are, and the book is dedicated to them, this book, and they're always our first readers. And one of them, Lynn, said at the original ending, you know, really, can we have a little bit more hope here? So we went back and talked about it and said, well, all right, well, you know, and it did make
sense. A little bit more. Yes.
Yeah, it did make sense to leave it a little bit more open.
I have another question for Lynn and Val. I was thinking about this in relation to my son and daughter get along really well, though they didn't when they were little, but they do now. And they were both out to our weekend home here for the same weekend. And all of a sudden they got back into this little thing that was like 15 years ago, acting. And I think just because they hadn't been together in a long time because of the pandemic, it was just sort of like something triggered the way they act when they were younger. Do you guys ever, as you are working, find yourself falling into any little thing, any kind of old role that you had when you were younger?
Oh, never, never, never.
Oh, shame on you, your nose is growing.
That's right.
But how do you deal with that? Do you ever like say, let's take a breather, or do you have a system for coping with writing with your sister?
We didn't have a lot of those sibling, you know, fights because we have 13 years between us. So by the time Valerie and I really became close, I was a teenager when I was spending every weekend and every summer with her and sneaking cigarettes, you know, at her house. Not that I'm smoking anymore, but this was a long time ago. And so, you know, we've always, our relationship has really always been friendship based. It has not ever, we've never had that sibling rivalry of, oh, mom liked you better, or that, you know, nothing like that. So we really feel like we had different parents in a sense, right? And then, you know, whatever we wanted to, you know, complain about or commiserate about, we were always there for each other. So there's really not that. Now, if I was writing with my brothers, definitely, it would be a completely, right, different story. Yeah,
the two brothers are between us.
Yeah.
Right. I'm the oldest, and the two boys come, and then Lynn. Yeah. So, yeah. So we never really had that. You know, she was a little baby. I was like, oh, I can't, you know, why would I fight with her?
Yeah. 13 years, there can't be sibling rivalry. I don't know.
It's like two different families. That's really interesting because Lee Child and his brother Andrew are 13 years apart.
Oh,
and so, you know, that argues that they will have a functional and good, not, you know, difficult relationship. Right. Patrick, it's time to call you up from the briny deep or wherever it is you're lurking and see if we have questions for everybody. There you are.
Well, it's funny you should ask that because a question just came in. Valerie and Lynn, you seem to do all of your appearances together in addition to writing. Do you ever need to take a break from each other?
Yes. Lynn has given me some time off, actually, on these appearances, right?
Right. I think because we don't live in the same city, we really look at this as an opportunity to spend more time together. And I don't think we've really, I mean, maybe couple years ago we had a little bit of a stressful book tour when it was a lot in a row. We might have gotten a little tired and had to go off into our corners, but no, we're excited to be able to spend the time together. And when we're not in the doing a project and speaking every day and a couple of days goes by, it's weird, and then we'll call each other and say, wow, I really missed talking to you
forever. Yes.
What was the genesis of how you decided to do this together?
Well, it's a long story, but we'll try to make it a 2 seconds since we wrote together our first book a long time, like over 20 some years ago. And we were always reading together, and it was really, we were reading a lot of ethnic fiction. And we said, you know, there's never really been a book that we know of about a Greek American family in this genre. So why don't we write one? And so we wrote it together. And then it was published by a small press. It's called Circle Dance. It's still out there. And then I moved to Connecticut, and we sort of got on with our lives. And it really wasn't until I went to Thriller Fest, maybe whatever, 10, 8 years ago or something, it kind of kickstarted everything. And then I said to Val, you've got to come with me. And we started writing together again.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
Patrick, another question?
Well, what about those, let's see here. Hold on just a second. From book to book, I'm not sure if you've actually already addressed this, but it does the balance of who does what kind of shift from book to book? Does one of you sort of do the heavy lifting on one book, or is it all equally kind of divided?
It's pretty equal. Yeah. I mean, we'll give each other, as Valerie said, if things can ebb and flow. So if all of a sudden a deadline comes up, I happen to be in Florida like a month ago when we had one of our self-imposed deadlines, and Valerie kind of took the lion's share and did a big edit, and then I looked at it when I got back, and then we're in the same boat now, and she's away, so I'm kind of doing that, but it really all evens out in the end. So and it's great because you do have that opportunity, like if one does need to say, hey, this is going on right now, the other one can step in, whether it's blogs or appearances or whatever. But we, you know, in the end it all washes out the same, I think.
Let me ask Kate a sort of related question, which is, Kate, you've written 8 books in a series And now you've been writing standalones. Do you find that it's a lot more energy to write those standalones because you have to like world build them from the beginning each time?
Oh, I love that world build. Unlike pivot or an agency, I'm going to keep that in my.
Thank you.
I love that. I find in some ways it is trickier because I've got to research the field the person is in. Unlike the Bailey Wagons, where I really knew her field, and I guess it was, she was a true crime writer at a magazine. And it's, I have to think about the voice and really go through a number of pages and to get that down and go back and then edit if I feel I hadn't gotten it down in the beginning. But I guess there's just so much more appeal now for readers to the standalone, because from what I've seen is that readers are, but you know, the Bailey Wagons still sell, but readers don't want to have to go back and read from the beginning, even though you tell them you don't have to do that. I think there's a sense of, wow, I can't really start on book 7 or 8. I've got to go back. And so I think, you know, just, I see a lot of people who wrote series now doing standalones, and that's probably going to be the way I do it. Though people write in and say, is there going to be another Bailey? And I hope at some point, yes, but not right now.
Well, you know, it's not just about the audience. I also think these kinds of stories, you can't really write sequels. I mean, they're whole and of themselves.
Yeah.
And you've got everybody in jeopardy, or everybody, you know, and at the end, the reader, one of the reasons people like them is that you don't know who the good or the bad guy is. You don't know who's going to survive the book. And, you know, there's a comfort in a series that's different, because in a series, you know, you're pretty sure that Jack Reacher, for example, is going to make it through the book. And go on to the next one. So it's a different reading experience all the way around. But you know, I think standalones are more effort for the author. They just have to be, because you have to create everything from scratch. On the other hand, if you're writing a series, you have to figure out how to keep people interested in it. So it's a different challenge.
They both require something, but there is a fun to doing the research on the characters' work and their life that adds a freshness for you. When you start in, you can be intrigued with it and feel like this is going to be interesting to find out.
Mm-hmm. Patrick, anything else?
Yeah, there's a question for Kate, which is, and Barbara, you might be better suited to answer this, which is, why are the wives and the fiance, why aren't they available in hardcover? Why are they only available in trade?
I can answer that question. In point of fact, HarperCollins has developed a model in which the trade paperback edition is the one that they really push, but they do a limited hardcover edition principally for libraries. And it isn't true for all of their authors, because the Constantine books come out just in hardcover and then move on to paperback. But Kate's books are available in a library edition, in a hardcover, as well as the paperback. But there is, I have to tell you, Kate, some pressure on me as a bookseller to sell the paperback, because that's the one that they're really pushing towards the bestseller list and so forth. And they're not really thrilled if I ordered the hardcover. I went through this with J.T. Ellison, where we actually had a fight about, not J.T. and I didn't, but you know, otherwise they didn't really want me to buy the hardcover. And then because it would split the sales and split the reporting and so forth. And because they don't necessarily print a lot of them. And if I bought a bunch, then libraries X, Y, and Z might not get any. And so, you know, it's an interesting business model, but doesn't have anything to do with Kate or the quality of her books. It's irrelevant.
It's really the division I went with HarperCollins, Harper Perennial, and that's the model. And I think that it's just something that, I think there's probably a downside to it, but I write the same kind of books that I would write if I were, you know, it was a hardcover.
I don't don't think there's a downside to it. Other publishers are doing it too. Sourcebooks does it. Berkeley does some of it. It's just a business decision. And frankly, a lot of it's experimental to try to figure out, you know, where the larger market resides. Mm-hmm. Right. And some of it may be just purely pitched at consumer pocketbooks, thinking that you'll sell more books at a price point of $16 or $17 than you will at $28 or $29. And people are gathering data, and nothing is written in stone. So, you know, they may very well change. Actually, years and years ago, back in the very early 90s, Berkeley was experimenting with printing a hardcover, a trade paperback, and a mass market all at the same time. You had all three. And the one that got lost was the trade paperback. The hardcover did well, and the mass market did well, and nobody cared about the big paperback in the middle, so they dropped it.
Right.
So I think this is all, a lot of this is just evolutionary. You know, for a while, everybody was terrified that digital books were going to wipe out print books, and then it turns out that lots of people, me, for example, don't want to read a digital book, and, you know, and so print books didn't completely vanish. I think it's great they're experimenting.
But can I ask you a question now that we have you, because you're looking at data all the time, you're looking at your restock information. What can you tell us as authors, any interesting trends you're seeing that you can give us a little hint of that we can then turn around and use in our own lives as authors and marketers of our books?
Well, first, you're really sweet to say that I'm data-driven, but the truth is I'm 100% intuitive. I'm really terrible with numbers.
Well, you have a lot of agency with data. I know you do.
If you were to come back through the Facebook videos that we have, you will find that Jane Ann Krentz and J.T. Ellison and I have had a couple of sessions about what I think is the big thing of the moment, which is the Gothic. And I think the Gothic, although how to define that, is an outgrowth of the trust no one. And people are not using the Gothic in, it's being used in a very broad term. It's being confused with Agatha Christie and a locked room or country house murder. And that's different than like the Castle of Otranto or the Fall of the House of Usher or Rebecca, which is, but, I think that Australian noir is replacing Scandi noir, for example. You're getting a lot more books from Australia right now than you, but that's not anything you're going to care about because that's not what you're writing. What actually happens is that whenever there is a trend towards some kind of a genre, it becomes so overloaded that people get tired of it. And there's a lot of bad books that come into it. I mean, there's some great books that started, okay? And people go, oh, wow, you know, I just read Gone Girl or something, you know, or The Last Mrs. Parrish. And, you know, they go, wow. But then, you know, a lot of people rush in because they think, okay, if that one worked, I can write one, two or something, and they're not as good. And then readers eventually get turned off. They read too many books that aren't very good, or they think, I mean, the Da Vinci Code led to Da Vinci Clones. And there were like 4 or 5 years where the only books you could actually get were religious conspiracy thrillers. Everybody wanted to write the Da Vinci Code all over again, right? And then we moved on. And so it's really hard. Patrick may be able to tell you better than I. Patrick, what do you think is the, I mean, look at S.A. Crosby, for example, a really hot author at the moment. What does he write? What would you call it?
He writes great books is all I know.
Yeah, I mean, they're good character-driven kind of noir. I don't know. I think it's so hard to say. I mean,
you just think noir is having an upswell?
I don't know. I mean, what is noir? That's the big thing.
Oh, well, there we go. Right. What's Gothic?
What I was going to say, I think that there's something in the air. What's going on in the country, maybe the tensions globally that speaks to people at certain times. And I think that perhaps, you know, this resurgence of interest in the classic, you know, British model, the Agatha Christie kind of traditional mystery is really interesting. And I don't think it's accidental, you know? I think that a lot of things are going on that people like books that have a nice resolution, you know? And also, you know, these trends in, over the last, what, Barbara, 15 years or something, you know, 20 years ago, World War II novel, the espionage novel, was kind of in a slump, was in a trough, you know. And World War I was completely off the, out of the genre, except for Charles Todd, maybe just starting out. But there are all these World War I and World War II novels that have saturated the market. And so people are going back and looking at the real books that were produced during that period, you know, discovering all these golden age mysteries. So I don't know.
We're taking notes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Actually, World War II is the women's stories of World War II that have really surged. I mean, after the war, we had all kinds of great stuff by Alistair MacLean and the Guns of Navarone and, you know, all this wonderful sort of, you know, military or whatever it is. But if you look now, it's all about booksellers and, you know, librarians and nurses. And I mean, all these amazing women's stories coming out of the war.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think triumph over adversity too is really something that people really want to read, you know, as we all go through this crazy ass time that we're in.
I'll tell you what, Kate, I promise that as soon as I figure out the next one, I will tell you first. How's that?
All right. Well, I'll tell Val and Lynn too.
But, yes. But you guys have done a wonderful job. And I do think in a genre that is so popular that these two books are a huge standout. So I can't recommend The Fiancé and The Stranger in the Mirror enough.
Thank you so much.
Autographed by the kindness of the authors. And authors, thank you for supporting us by being willing to do that, because it's a lot of work for you. We realize that we've turned authors into essentially shipping clerks.
No, thank you.
We haven't figured out a better way for us as a bookstore to connect with readers than to give them something that feels personal to them.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So we really appreciate your doing that. And since it's a Friday, TGIF, everybody has a perfectly wonderful weekend. I'm going out and have dinner with John Sanford and his wife here at
That's called burying the lead.
So if John tells me something that I, you know, he's working on or that is going to be a trend, I will
let us know.
Anyway, have a wonderful weekend. Thank you all for joining me.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye. Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.